Synthetic biology, probably a term you have not heard of, or maybe you have. We're going to be talking about it and future generation biofuels and how they relate. And a couple of guests, John Greenler, he stops by every so often to talk with us. John, good to see you.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks, Larry.
John is Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, the GLBRC, as we sometimes call it. Brian Flegger is an assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at the UW-Madison. Brian, good to have you with us as well.
Thanks for the invitation.
All right. What is synthetic biology? Brian, we're going to turn to you for that.
Absolutely. So synthetic biology is a new form of engineering, or the application of engineering principles in a new arena. So the idea comes from the concept of regular engineering, where we take small parts and blueprints, and we put those parts together to build bigger machines or bigger functions. So the idea here is we're going to look at the building blocks of cells, which are DNA, proteins, and other small molecules, mm-hmm. and assemble them to do different biological functions. So those functions could include producing biofuels.
Okay, and that's where the GLBRC comes in, I would expect, Brian. And John, comment?
It's, I think it really, as we look, down the pike further in terms of, producing ethanol and other potential fuels, it really holds a lot of promise to, both address issues of, where is our energy going to come from in the future? And also, how are we going to address some of the climate change problems, other environmental problems, for example, by being able to use new types of biomass that could be grown in a sustainable fashion, or a lot of residues from our current agricultural or forestry industries.
Yeah. Brian, could you give me an example of a practical example of how synthetic biology works in this arena?
Absolutely. So the idea for synthetic biology, I guess if I give a little bit of history, comes from genetic engineering. So geneticists for a long time have wanted to study the function of genes and what they do to biological systems. So if you wanted to say, no, what genes were involved in producing ethanol, you would do a study where you would knock out genes and find the ones that couldn't produce ethanol. So the flip to that would be to take that gene and add it back to an organism that couldn't produce ethanol and maybe give it the ability to produce ethanol. So the question now with synthetic biology is, are there better or other things that we might want to make besides things that are already out there? So the idea with next generation biofuels is, are there molecules that are available in nature, but maybe not necessarily in the microorganisms that, say, GLBRC is interested in, that could be engineered to produce these other molecules? So I can give an example.
Yeah, give us an example.
So work that I was involved in as a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, we looked at the production of a small molecule called artemisinin. So this is an anti-malarial compound. It's a molecule that's made by plants in Southeast Asia. It's called Artemisia annua, or sweet wormwood. Mm-hmm. And it's been used and known to treat malaria for a long, long time. The problem with the process to extract that compound from the plants is that it's nasty. It involves some solvents that are not exactly environmentally friendly, and the yields from year to year could be highly variable due to whatever crop limitations might be imposed upon the climate or the political environment of that year. So the real problem with malaria is the cost to treat the disease. It's not that we don't have scientific abilities to produce molecules to fight. It's our ability to deliver them. So the idea here was, can we take the parts, the genes or the proteins from the plant that makes this molecule and confer it to an organism that we can control? So if you take a bacteria or a yeast, we're very good at growing those and making molecules such as alcohols or beers out of those types of organisms. And if we can take those genes and put them into bacteria, we can then brew these drugs. And that's been done and is actually it's a great success story out there at the University of California. Mm-hmm.
So they've come up with an inexpensive way to treat that problem.
Absolutely. So they've come up with a way to, instead of growing plants, we can grow easier to grow organisms such as bacteria to produce these small molecules.
If you'd like to join in with your own question, I hope you will. Give us a call as we visit with John Greenler and Brian Flegger of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the number 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Matt in Lake Geneva. Matt, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. With regard to biofuels, I'm interested in biofuels production that could take place on the community level. And I'm wondering if any of these advances, like biofuels from, say, algae growth, if any of this stuff is being designed to be able to be done without massive amounts of capital. You know, I'd like to see the fuel production be more localized and be in the hands of smaller collections of people.
Yeah, good question. Brian, what about it?
Well, I think you see that in the biodiesel community especially. So there's I know a number of organizations have been founded to help people in local communities collect various waste oils and to develop model systems in their own garages to convert that waste oil into biodiesel that can be burned in retrofitted engines. As far as next generation biofuels, I think that's going to be a challenge. And I think that's something that as engineers, we need to figure out ways. Is that the most efficient or cost effective way of producing these fuels? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the major challenges to that is figuring out the scale that is most appropriate. And that's definitely research that's ongoing.
Yeah. John, a comment?
Yeah, actually, as Brian mentioned, the issue of scale is one that is, really important to be considering in terms of the technologies and trying to find kind of a sweet spot, a balance point between, what is going to be efficient in terms of, scaling up versus, once again, we get back to that sustainability consideration. Are we making sure that things are tuned for, the various communities or whatnot, where the crops might be being grown or where the need is. And there's a lot of variation on this, both in terms of, looking at what we might need here in the United States. And then we really see a very different picture. For example, if we look, globally and we're looking at a developing country, for example, they may need something that fits on a very different type of scale as well. And I think the good news is as the technology advances further, there'll be more adaptability and be able to look at, what is the most appropriate scale for production of the crop and then corresponding conversion into a biofuel.
Mm-hmm. All right. Matt, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Andreas in La Crosse, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Andreas.
Certainly. I just want to say how excited I am about this being one of the positives of living in the future. The ideas that we're talking about today are more advanced than I think we could have imagined even a decade ago. And I really think some of the positive answers can occur from the research that you're talking about, particularly at the University of California. And I'll take
comments
here.
All right, fine. Brian, maybe have you both comment, but Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time for this area of research. I think the number of scientists that are interested in these questions and are approaching the solutions to these problems from unique angles, including engineering biological systems, which isn't something that was conceivable maybe a decade ago, it makes this the explosion. I know a person in the industry who refers to this as the pre-Cambrian explosion. So there's an enormous number of new technologies that are coming online and being developed each year. The real challenge now is going to be filtering out the ones that aren't going to work. So I think there's a lot of exciting opportunities out there for researchers, in particular students.
Yeah. John?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to be panaceic. I think clearly the challenges we face are really significant. But, I think the positive is that I think in many ways, and I think, this topic today is a good example of where, from that challenge, I think we really are looking at some fundamental new opportunities that will really allow us to move forward in a very positive way.
Yeah. Frank in Oshkosh, we're on to you now. Hi, Frank.
Hello. This is a very, very interesting conversation. My question goes along the lines of when you create the bacteria, who owns the patent on that form? Will the university own the patent? And I guess my concern is, I think one of you said you were from California, and you're probably aware of Lawrence Lessig. And my concern is similar to his. When corporations and small numbers of people hold the patents on these, will it be available to the public? Or what are the, there's some issues involved in that. I'd like to have you folks make a comment on that.
Sure. Let's, Brian, go to you.
So I can speak to a couple of angles on that question. I mean, one, all research that's funded at the university is patented by the university. So the rights to those inventions are negotiated by the university. I can speak to the specific case we were talking about before, about artemisinin, and those were great agreements that have been the model for making things available for near cost. So I'm not at liberty to speak about the specific numbers, but
right.
These are patents that are being licensed at minimal profits to the companies that are going to then be producing these things, especially in cases where you're talking about drugs for the developing world.
Okay. And John, any comment?
Just kind of somewhat of an extension on that is, in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, we really recognize the opportunity to collaborate with industry as well. And as Brian was saying, we work with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF. And the idea is, within academia, we're really good at a certain, once again, coming back to that concept of scale, we're good at a kind of a research scale. We're good at the benchtop and kind of seeing how things look, at this kind of starting point. But we also recognize as we begin to think about how do we really scale up production of biofuels, that's where we begin to need to look at that collaboration with industrial partners to see, what's really possible, in that domain of really high volume production. And so we're really kind of very cognizant of that, that handoff and how we do that is really critical and important to us.
Yeah. And thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have more callers online here, and I know we have a caller who's not very favorable toward biofuels, and would certainly be glad to take that call and talk about that as well. There's no problem with that. But we are in the position of needing to take a look at the news and weather and finding out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. So I hope that caller will hang on and we'll get to that. John Greenler, Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center at UW-Madison, one of our guests. The other, Brian Flegger, is also at the UW-Madison in the College of Engineering in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking synthetic biology and the future generation biofuels with our two guests today, John Greenler and Brian Flegger. John directs the education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and Brian's an assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at UW-Madison. So great to have them with us. And you can join in. I think we have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. And John, just to recap, basically synthetic biology is Brian, go ahead.
So synthetic biology is the next generation of engineering, where we're going to look at engineering biological systems. So the same ideas that we use in traditional engineering disciplines, where we have parts and blueprints, and we put things together to make machines or higher order functions, we're going to try to do the same thing in biological systems. So we're trying to build organisms that can produce, say, next generation biofuels.
All right. And there's something, a program here at UW that you're really fond of. It's called the iGEM program. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Yeah. So iGEM is a program that started out of MIT in 2004, and it's a program for undergraduates. So like many of the research opportunities on the various college campuses around the country, iGEM is a program where we can bring students in for about 12 weeks over the summer, and they do independent research. So they come up with the ideas, they brainstorm how the project should be assembled, and then they do the work. And on top of that, then they write up a summation, a presentation that they then get to go and give at a conference that's held at MIT each fall. And that conference is called the iGEM Jamboree. And it really is, it symbolizes that type of fun. So this is an environment where over 100 teams of students from around the country and around the world get to interact, mingle. They're all, young people, very energetic, and with amazing ideas. The creativity that I see in a weekend here for the iGEM program is just absolutely outstanding. So what we do at UW is we have a small team of six students this year. They're currently developing or brainstorming their ideas, and I'm looking really looking forward to what they're going to come up with to work on for this summer. So.
And your own research as it relates to biofuels, tell about a little bit about
that. Yeah, so what we're doing in the laboratory is we're engineering E. coli, which is our favorite bacteria, to produce diesel fuel. So we're looking at not the biodiesel as it's currently formed. That's what's called fatty acid methyl esters. So this is a particular chemical form. We're actually looking at making hydrocarbons. So that gets rid of this ester functionality. So that's going to give superior properties and the ability to blend in right with current petrodiesel alternatives. So it would be a transition period as well. Mm-hmm. So what we've done is we've engineered the production of fatty acids, which are a biological molecule that many organisms, including humans, have lots of in their body. So it's something we know we can make a lot of. And we've over-engineered this organism to produce lots of these fatty acids. And now we're investigating ways to make specific compounds that are better fuels from these fatty acids. So this is the synthetic biology mm-hmm. part. So we're taking genes from various organisms, and we're using those genes to convert fatty acids into various forms, such as, say, a fatty alcohol, the molecules that you mm-hmm. see in biodiesel now, or even molecules through chemical catalysis that are essentially regular diesel, which you would get at your gasoline pump.
Very cool. Let's turn to Tom in Mequon now. Tom, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Interesting show. I would like to say that I would like to see the government defund programs like this, because I think they're a waste of taxpayer money on almost every level. Not that the guys that you're talking to aren't doing good work, but I still think that economically it's a waste of money, because it's always going to be more expensive than regular diesel or gasoline. And I think it's morally wrong, too, because I think it's morally wrong to strip the earth of its nutrients and, to put in people's gas tanks or our truck tanks. And I think it's also hard on the third world, because as corn goes up in price, it makes it hard for the people in Mexico and in Africa and other places, because it's a lot more expensive for them to buy corn and use it as a food product, and also cost more to raise meat. And also, farmers are favoring corn, and they're making it so it's difficult to plant other products, and so those crops are going up in price also.
All right, well, you raised a number of questions, and probably both right. John, maybe we start with you for some response.
Yeah, Tom, I think you raise a lot of really important points, which, I think largely are focused on kind of our current biofuels technology. And really what we're talking about today is being able to move forward and address a lot of, the issues that you are raising specifically. So starting out with, more expensive, when we're producing biofuels from things like corn grain, as you mentioned, clearly grain is a very high value commodity. It takes a lot to produce that grain, and it has a lot of value as food. And really what we're looking at in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and in second or third generation advanced biofuels in general is using materials that get away from using these food-based biomass materials. So, for example, after we've raised the corn and harvested the grain, what we have left over is what's known as corn stover, the stems and leaves. Some of that we need to return to the earth, to the ground, to maintain good soil fertility. But a portion of that can be used, for example, to produce biofuels. It gets complicated, but there's a lot of what's known as cellulosic material in that stover. It's that fibrous material that we kind of associated with, with a corn stalk or a leaf or whatever. And we're really looking at the technology to be able to take that and make biofuels such as ethanol. And another example that many people are familiar with is switchgrass, and we can grow switchgrass in a very healthy, positive way on land that wouldn't be appropriate for growing food type crops, annual type crops like corn or soybeans. In terms of the environmental considerations, once again, these are really kind of folded directly in. If we're using waste residues such as corn stover, this is material that's left over, and it's a very similar story for switchgrass. Switchgrass is a perennial crop. When we grow it actually builds soil in parallel, because these roots continue to develop for many, many years. And furthermore, they actually the switchgrass takes carbon out of the atmosphere and, functionally speaking, puts it into the ground, sequesters it by building all those roots, and therefore it's addressing some of our climate change issues as well.
Yeah, I just want to comment from the synthetic biology part point of view. While this isn't going to happen tomorrow, the idea is that we're the the projects that we're working on now are applicable to organisms such as cyanobacteria, which are photosynthetic and can not just function off of sugars or crop residues, but the carbon dioxide that we're trying to deplete from the atmosphere. So I think down the road, there are definite paths that get away from a lot of these current issues surrounding, you know, the production of corn-based fuels.
And what about his comment relating to destroying, you know, in third world areas, environmental destruction and so forth?
Well, once again, you know, when we, you know, as we look towards the future and moving away from, you know, a competition between, well, are we going to grow a crop for food or is it going to be for fuels? You know, then we're really unplugging from this, you know, this very complex, you know, issue in terms of, you know, commodity prices for things like corn grain. And I think furthermore, it's very interesting to look kind of at the global international developments, but there's a lot of opportunities on the horizon because of developing technologies that would allow for production of fuels in third world developing countries that we really don't have today. Jatropha is a good example that we could talk about at some point in the future. It's its own story with its complexities. But, you know, once again, I think the story that Brian brought up, you know, earlier on in terms of, you know, developing, you know, new solutions for malaria, I think there's some potential for, you know, by using these technologies, there's some potential to really do something very similar on the fuels front, on the energy front, with some of these future generation biofuels as well.
Yeah. Tom, I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give some others a chance to join in as well. The other point is, I guess, you know, the gasoline is, I mean, oil isn't going to last forever. And if we're going to be, we can't just wait for it to run out, I guess, to come up with alternatives for it.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And especially when we look at the fuels that we need for transportation, we're really very much dependent upon petroleum products, you know, what we can make from crude oil. And you know, the data is very clear. I mean, we are still finding some new oil fields out there. But and some of the, you know, even in the past year, there's been interesting discoveries. But those discoveries are going to become fewer and fewer. And even some of these recent discoveries are going to, you know, to get that oil, to extract that oil, is going to be very, very expensive. So functionally speaking, you know, we're really, you know, looking in the not too distant future, most likely, of having oil that, you know, from an economic perspective, is really just not going to be accessible to us. So.
All right. Tom, thanks again. Appreciate it. Let's see. We have some more callers online. Ron in Mason, we'll go to you. Ron, hello.
Yes, I'm wondering if you people watched a 60-minute show this last weekend on the Bloombox.
No, we did not. My guest did not.
This is all biofuel, and it's something they came up with. They're already online with Walmart and several other big corporations on heating whole houses with a unit that only is about the size of a deck of cards.
I saw the promotion for it and did not get a chance to see it. And it's something that we're going to have to – I really wanted to look into it too, Ron, because it's an example – hopefully it's an example of what research and, you know, looking at these – looking at the topic from a ton of different angles can really maybe produce some fantastic benefits.
There's a really wide range of opportunities out there.
I'll tell you what, Ron, I'll be looking into that a little further, and maybe John can bring that back sometime with us for discussion. Thank you for calling, though, and bringing it back to my attention. David in Livingston, we'll turn to you. Hi, David.
How's it going?
Good.
What I'm curious about is biogas and why we can't use these sewage municipalities in conjunction with an anaerobic digester to produce methane to offset the price of natural gas. And since I'm on the road, I'll take the rest off the air.
Okay. Brian, you want to try that?
So I think the caller makes an excellent point. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities to use various waste sources for different fuel applications. I think the expertise that I have is focused more on the liquid transportation sector, so things that are going to drive trucks, planes, and trains. But certainly there are people, even within the state of Wisconsin, that are very interested in anaerobic digestion and what can be done for producing electricity or for, you know, the heating value of buildings. So I think it's an excellent point.
Yeah.
It's clear, you know, we really need to take advantage of all of these possible, you know, energy sources. You know, the numbers that I've seen, you know, when you look at the big picture in terms of how much energy, you know, we currently need, we're not going to really be able to go the distance with, you know, anaerobic digestion of methane. We need to make sure that we're capturing all of that energy, but we're really going to need to go beyond that. And that's where looking at things like, you know, biofuels based on cellulosic materials is really important, because there's such an abundance of this material out there that, you know, we have the potential to get a really large return on our research investment.
Yeah. Let's turn to Jim in Waukegan, Illinois next. And by the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. My question involves the leaves of plants. They're great at capturing the energy. And I was wondering where the science might be in manufacturing chloroplasts, or at least the organelles that make up chloroplasts, things like grana, and if that is being looked at in a synthetic sense.
All right. Brian, you want to take that?
Sure. So I think that's an excellent point. I mean, the idea right now for producing biofuels comes from harvesting terrestrial or existing algae species to harvest sunlight. So that's going to produce a biomass that we then have to deconstruct and make fuels from. I'm not a business major, but I think there's a middleman there that we can probably eliminate. So if you can engineer an organism to harvest sunlight and produce fuels directly, I think you've saved or made your process more efficient. And what's been done, I'm not intimately familiar with this field, but I know there are a number of researchers who have taken photosystems, the things that are important for capturing sunlight, and delivered them to organisms that aren't usually able to do that type of or get that type of energy. So, for instance, E. coli has been engineered to be able to generate ATP from light, which is the energy carrier in the cell. And I think this is an area that's going to continue. So a number of research groups are looking at increasing not only the photo capturing equipment, but also the carbon dioxide sequestering. So I think that's also the second point.
Very cool. Thank you very much, Jim, for that question. Appreciate it. And Randy in Oshkosh, on to you now. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. See, I was just wondering, I read in two different articles, one in Scientific American and the other in Natural History a number of years ago, and they both brought up the use of crystallized methane gas that occurs, I guess, at the polar regions and the ocean bottoms and continental shelves. And according to these articles, there's enough known reserves there to equal all the known coal and oil reserves that we have. They claim that there'd be 150 years worth of use out of this
crystallized methane.
And, you know, you could easily convert a vehicle to run methane just like you can LP, as well as, you know, heating your house with. I mean, why isn't this being talked about more or looked into more?
Well, it probably is, if it's viable. Any ideas, John?
Well, you know, I have heard a little bit about this, but not a lot. But I can tell you one of the concerns that I guess my guess is would come up pretty quickly is this is a source of energy that's carbon based, which is currently, you know, kind of locked up, is sequestered a lot, like coal, as you said. And, you know, one of the things that we're really trying to look at is minimizing the release of greenhouse gases. And anytime, you know, we look at utilizing these types of energy sources that are carbon-based, that are locked up, you know, in any of a number of different ways, you know, in our Earth's, you know, crust or whatnot, is we're talking about releasing carbon in the atmosphere, and that's gonna really potentially be a significant challenge, you know, with climate change. And so my guess is, you know, one of the big, you know, reasons for not pursuing that is because it might really aggravate the climate change issue.
All right. Thank you for calling. Nevin in Spring Valley, your turn. Hi, Nevin.
Kevin,
right. Sorry.
My question is, has anybody just tried taking whatever vegetation you want, grind it up, put it in a drum, set it in the sun, and leave it alone for, you know, even just a year or so and see what you get afterwards? I think it's neat to go with all the microbes and all that, but I think nature might have the best recourse, which is just letting it sit in the sun and letting it wait and brew, and then it basically is, it's oil waiting to go.
All right, let's turn to Brian.
I think what you'll find inside that barrel are bacteria and microorganisms that we're looking at. That's not to say that your idea it isn't without merit. I think there are other platforms besides biological platforms, things like making pyrolysis oil, which would be making a bio oil, as you suggest, on a shorter time frame, or even things like gasification, which can make syngas, which chemists are fond of using to make various fuels that could be burned. So I think there are plenty of opportunities beyond microorganisms, and I'm not naive enough to think that that's the only solution out there. But these are things that are all being pursued out in the research environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. You know, there are, you know, if you put that natural material into that barrel, there are all these microbes, you know, they're there. And really a lot of what we're trying to do is really optimize that very process. So we have a lot of researchers in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center that are doing what's known as bioprospecting, looking for those microbes in all sorts of interesting places, and then essentially trying to forge an alliance with those microorganisms to help us really efficiently, economically, create, you know, biofuels from, you know, those types of residue materials, and, you know, and you know, leafy material is a really good candidate for that. So, you know, we range, you know, quite widely looking for microbes that could really help us out, you know, from the thermal pools at Yellowstone, where there's organisms that can essentially be living at, you know, boiling temperatures, to actually the microbial chambers associated with leafcutter ants in South America. So we're really looking for, you know, what are the little critters out there that can really help us out in this this project.
All right. Thanks, Kevin, for calling. John and Baraboo, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks, Larry, and the guests for taking my call. I am in my vehicle, so I'll take the reactions off the air when I'm finished, but I have a great deal of respect for the topic and have just a bit of a concern about how sometimes some of the sources of material gets characterized as waste. But in my specific example would be how sometimes things like corn stover get characterized as waste when in fact they're a important part of nutrient and carbon cycling and sequestration in soil. So I'm a little bit concerned when I hear a blanket, blanket characterization such as that, and also just a blanket use of materials like that, because there's a lot of nuance to that topic. So for example, if soils are being farmed in ways that are responsible and sustainable, maybe that is an option. But if the soil is being tilled annually, then we're probably going to be worried more about loss of carbon from a situation like that than we are sequestering it. So sometimes it seems like there's competing interests here.
Sure, and I want to break in just because we've only got a couple minutes left, and I think John, you've raised a good issue. And John Greenler, a comment?
Yeah, once again, John, I really appreciate your question, because it is really important. And in GLBRC, for example, we actually have a very substantial team of ecologists and agronomists who are looking at these very questions. So, for example, and I feel badly using the word waste, because you're exactly right. It's really not a waste material. In the world of agronomy, we would call it a residue. And it's very clear, for example, with corn stover, that it's important that we put a significant portion of that back into the soil to feed the microbes, to make sure that the carbon levels are high in that soil. And so we're looking very carefully at, you know, at both here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, actually in Michigan State University as well. We have a whole set of trial plots where we're really, you know, trying to very scientifically answer exactly those kinds of questions. You know, what can we do sustainably in terms of really taking care of all the dimensions of a healthy agricultural ecological system?
Oh. And John, I thank you very much for calling. And John Greenler and Brian Flegger, thank you so much for being with us as well today. And we'll look forward to hopefully have you on again.
Thanks. Thanks, Larry.
Love to have you back. Brian Flegger, Assistant Professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at UW-Madison. John Greenler, Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And actually, we try to cover at least once a month, we try to cover these kinds of issues, especially relating to biofuels. And I really appreciate the guys coming by today, and we'll do it again. Coming up tomorrow, oh, it's tax time. Don't you know it's Madison CPA Steve Schmidt will be along to help us with our taxes. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.